Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to see Rowan Kallick back at the Sydney Institute, and he will be introduced by Deborah Hazelton, who's a member of the board of the Asia Society. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Gerard, and welcome everyone. I'm here standing in for Warwick Smith tonight, who is the chair of the Asia Society Australia. I'd like to welcome you all here to this international book launch of Rowan Kallick's new book, Party Time, Who Runs China and How? I'm welcoming you on behalf of Sydney Institute, of course, the Asia Society, and with thanks to Clayton Utz for their generous sponsorship. Rowan Kallick doesn't need any introduction, I'm sure. Asia Pacific editor for Australian, past China correspondent for AFR and The Australian, senior writer in The Time magazine monthly, long time incisive writer on China, 20 odd years. And as you would well know, winner of the coveted Graham Perkin Award for Australian Journalist of the Year, as well as two Walkleys. The book's an important book. It's a fabulous read, but it's important also because it educates us on who is, or the pervasive control of the Chinese Communist Party in contemporary China. That arguably makes the Chinese Communist Party the most powerful institution in the world. So without saying any more, Rowan, could you tell us more, please?
Thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for coming. Rather than staying at home and studying form and deciding who you're going to vote for, thank you for coming tonight. It's a real sign of the difference between Australia and China that when I arrived at the airport... I live in Melbourne. And I arrived at the airport. There were people enabling you to vote right there at Kingston Smith Airport on the spot. 2 weeks ago, I was sipping yak butter tea in the house of a herder in eastern Tibet. His had become a marvellous life, he assured me, since the People's Republic of China had conducted its peaceful revolution, and not only chased out the splittist Dalai Lama, but removed the feudalism of which the discredited Dalai was at the pinnacle. I was aided everywhere I went on my visit to Tibet by the helpful comradeship of no less than 7 Chinese officials, 2 coming from the State Council in Beijing and the others from the Tibet Autonomous Regional Government. They kindly identified that friendly bloke as the sort of yak herder I could really learn from. To demonstrate his credentials, he, like strangely pretty well everyone else we met on our week-long visit, had a poster on his wall of 4 of the celestials, Mao, Deng, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao. He was unutterably grateful, he said, that he had 2 years earlier been invited to Beijing and been allowed to visit to view the remains of Chairman Mao in his mausoleum at the centre of Tiananmen Square. I started to feel a sort of claustrophobia after half an hour of this, which was rather more distressing than the altitude sickness more usually associated with Tibet, and decided to cut to the quick. "Have you been allowed to apply for party membership?" I asked him. He curtly nodded and turned away. Even for a yak herder in remote Tibetan mountains, it's party time. The pervasiveness of we just heard of the party is extraordinarily impressive. This reinforced, of course, by China's remarkable economic rise is what makes it the single most powerful organisation in the world. Pope John Paul II had the measure of the Soviet Union, but his successors cannot emulate the authority of the CCP. What prompted me to write this book? Chiefly the views I began hearing from Australians I met when I was living in Beijing. When I gave a couple of talks to visiting business people and to touring teachers about what I was discovering about how China was run, I got the feedback, "Why are you even mentioning the Communist Party when everything we've seen on our visit to Shanghai and Beijing has been so modern and capitalist, has looked so Western, when everyone we've met has spoken English and therefore been so European-minded? Surely the picture of Mao in the Tiananmen Gate is just there for tourists, like the horse guards outside Buckingham Palace." Well, where to start when seeking to converse with people whose understanding of China is like that? Quite common. There's only one place to start, I felt, with Chinese people. I started to interview people with a big range of voices about how their countries run. And this book is the outcome of those extensive interviews and of my own attempt to arrange them in a coherent pattern. What's it like living in Beijing today, living in China today? Well, living in Beijing is like living in ancient Rome or in London at the height of the British Empire. You feel that you're at the centre of things, that the world is coming to you, that the future is now. You're living in the present tense. The shopping malls are bigger and more glittering. The subway, hugely extended for the Olympics, larger and cleaner. The vast modernist apartment complex is more avant-garde. The nightclubs glitzier. The food more sumptuous. The art zanier than you can find anywhere else. Architects from the old European centres, French, British, Dutch, German, have been flocking here to help construct the new Beijing, creating dramatic buildings they could only dream of back home. Among them, Albert Speer Jr., the son of Adolf Hitler's favourite architect, whose design for the new public security ministry projects a suitably monumental image just to the east of Tiananmen Square, opposite the Beijing Hotel. He was commissioned to create a master plan for the whole Olympic zone to the north of the city, connecting it to the heart of the capital. He claimed that his plan was bigger, much bigger, than what his father had in mind for Berlin. Chinese people prefer not to consider such comparisons with the faded empires of Europe. Since their civilization, the world's oldest, began, they've sensed that they are themselves a very special group. During modern times, they've used the Chinese characters Zhongguo, Central Kingdom, to describe their country. Influential ideological commentators denigrate the notion of universal values such as human rights, freedom and democracy, constitutionality and the rule of law, dismissing them as peculiarly Western. The core objective of Chinese modernity, they argue, should instead be to enhance the prosperity and capacity of the state. But while China's physical landscape has been revolutionized in the 21st century, and while people's lifestyles, especially in the cities, continue to evolve rapidly, China's core institutions have remained almost unchanged since 1949. The five-yearly congresses are still crucial. The Politburo Standing Committee of seven men at the moment, no woman has yet become a member, remains the peak decision-making body. All government bodies, the ministries, the provincial governors, the mayors, are subordinate to the party policymakers. In official diagrams of the Chinese government, which can be found on office walls throughout the country, especially of foreign enterprises, as they puzzle over whom to approach for approvals, the structure of the government itself, with the State Council at its pinnacle, doesn't make it to the top half of the page. The upper branches are reserved for the Central Committee of the party and its General Secretary, now Xi Jinping. It's an organisation that has become brilliantly adaptive. It's no longer the party of revolution, but of sound management and stability. The party of the middle class and of the ruling families. The party, it likes to think, of China. So in recent decades, Westerners have tended to view material modernising progress as entailing an inexorable shift towards liberal democracy. But in China's case, no. Although it is shape-shifting to meet its own local challenges, it is not taking any steps towards becoming a liberal democracy that might be recognisable as such in the West. Their party is driven to adapt, but it's driven as much by fear as by vision or even opportunism. The party is more in command of China's institutions than ever, but is less certain in the internet age of what's going on in people's minds. The sound of distant thunder can be heard behind China's frequent national celebrations. Anxiety lurks in the minds of ordinary folk. What if we lose our jobs, or someone in the family becomes seriously ill, or inflation eats up our savings? And the rich and the ruling class also worry. Where does our legitimacy come from in the absence of elections? What if our privileged access to wealth is proven corrupt? China's leaders remain unconvinced about their capacity to retain the unmixed admiration of their own citizens. They fret endlessly about perceptions of the party's legitimacy for all its recent economic glories. The party takes care to associate itself with success of all kinds. This means, however, that it risks being implicated when things turn ugly. If it is all-powerful, it must be responsible for what goes wrong as well as what goes right. And the internet has made it extremely difficult for the party to cover things up as once it could, despite its tens of thousands of net police. This change was underlined by the lurid melodrama that began to go viral 16 months ago, first inside China and then around the world. Bo Xilai, a charismatic party leader on the verge of becoming one of the most powerful people in the country, was stripped of all his party posts, while his ultra-ambitious wife, characterised as a Chinese Lady Macbeth, was convicted of murdering an upper-class English businessman, Neil Haywood. This communist glamour couple have a socialite son educated at Harrow, Oxford and Harvard with a penchant for fast cars. They epitomise both the glittering promise held out by this great new age of prosperity and that distant thunder warning of troubles ahead. After casting out Bo, the party leadership regrouped by reaffirming its core task of maintaining stability. Wei Wen. But even as it did so, some within its ranks were arguing that the best way to achieve this was by a fresh wave of reforms, while others insisted that it was time to return to the party's long-established policies, purging heretics to the right and left. What's it like to be a member of the Chinese Communist Party? How do you join? What do you do at the meetings? Answers are not freely available. The party holds its secrets as close to its chest as Freemasons used to do, but with much more at stake. There are some things that I worked very hard to get information from about for this book, and I have to admit, remain a mystery. The party's budget remains a mystery. I must have spoken to every leading Sinologist in the world, and one or two of them told me they had themselves spent considerable time trying to find out, does the party have a budget? If so, where and how is it presented? Impossible to find out. It may emerge at some time, but I haven't cracked it. So let's try to answer that question about what's it like to be a member by meeting Liu Meiling, a smart, ambitious woman in her 30s who's working for a foreign Chinese joint venture in Wuhan, an ancient but dynamic city of about 10 million people in central China. Every month, she tells me, She and about a third of the 40 colleagues in her section of the firm file into a special party meeting room, either during their lunch hour or just after work. When their general manager enters the room, he's wearing, metaphorically, a different hat as general secretary of the firm's party branch. The primary business of these meetings is to relay instructions from officials higher up the chain of command. At many, perhaps most companies, the general manager is also the secretary of the department's party branch. Mei Ling says, "You have to be careful because he's also your boss. He's judging you related to your work performance. Everyone becomes careful and wants to say something to make the boss feel you're special. And you part plan what you're going to say, even in the most casual seeming conversations. It's not like at uni where you might become careless, you become careful. If you talk too much about your good deeds at meetings, people will think you're proud. Modesty is very acceptable in China," she says. "Most of the foreigners working at Liu's company, Mei Ling's company, are not aware that their firm has a party branch. They would be even more surprised to discover that someone as modern-minded, fluent in English, and generally savvy as her is a member. So why is the party still so attractive to aspiring young Chinese that now 84 million strong, it can turn away would-be members? How does it lure people like Mei Ling, whose Western counterparts are unlikely to join any organisation except a gym? The main attraction is success at both individual and national levels. Joining the party means joining a success story that opens the door to almost unlimited career opportunities. The party has placed itself in such a central role in so many dimensions of Chinese life that it now appears irreplaceable. And being a jealous party that brooks no rivals, it has no competitors. If you have ambitions in 21st century China, you need to think very hard before passing up a chance to join the party. Being part of the select group, the chosen people who wield such extraordinary authority, is naturally attractive to ambitious young people. Party patronage provides a crucial stepping stone towards prosperity. Smart young people head for jobs in the government or in state-owned enterprises these days, not so much with international firms, unless they're thinking of shifting overseas. Foreign firms may pay more, but they cannot compete with the state in offering access to assets, to flats, say, or to big new share issues. And the country's startling economic success has brought about a rejuvenation, therefore, of the party and an extension of its grip right into the heart of China's burgeoning private sector. Mei Ling became a party member in high school. Her parents were already members. They had to be. Her father worked in public security, and her mother, as a telephonist in pre-mobile days, had the opportunity to listen to important conversations. Both jobs could only be held by trusted party members. Liu's father, Mei Ling's father, still doesn't talk much about his job, amplifying her curiosity about it. When she entered junior middle school, she was told she could join the Young Pioneers, and she was among the majority who did so. They wear the red scarves celebrated in communist propaganda posters since the party's early days in power. Her parents encouraged her, saying it would improve her career prospects, as well as demonstrating that she was a good person. Three things were required to prove you were a good student, she says. To study well, have a healthy mind and body, and be politically sound. The few in the class who were left out without Young Pioneer scarves didn't really belong to the group. They were isolated. When she was 13 or 14, she graduated to junior party membership. She was a precocious young communist, she tells me. She applied by writing an essay explaining why she wanted to join. "You have to self-criticise," she recalls. "You have to state your shortcomings. One is enough. Usually people will say something like, 'I'm not seriously minded.' The answer the party leaders give is, 'Spend more time with classmates,' or 'Help people more.' at both of her universities. She's got 2 degrees. The branch secretaries are students, but a professor supervised meetings and will read news items or party documents and ask people to comment on them. Nothing serious, she says. Meetings were held every month in the office of a lecturer or professor or in a classroom. The party secretary of the department, always there. Usually they were held in the evenings after class, lasted about an hour. Nobody asked questions. We were all very passive, she says. Occasionally students would talk about politics. When officials read statements by party leaders, we commented how wise they were. Always very wise, but they were very dull, and no real business was conducted. When she graduated from university, her father helped her to obtain her first job. I knew he could do that, she said. I was aware he did it for other people, but I didn't want that. I didn't like it. She wanted to rely on herself and had told her mother, even when she was very young, she wouldn't use her parents' money. And she said, I read and reread the novel Jane Eyre. Like her, I wanted to be myself. I have to say, well, I've got a 19-year-old daughter. I wish she would read Jane Eyre. But anyway. And by now, her enthusiasm for the party had waned. She told me that during a party meeting when candidates were listed, she said, I sighed, apparently from the heat, but my ennui went deeper than that. I felt this is all removed from everyday life. People separate this party involvement out from their understanding of the world. Their membership is like an altar with a Buddha on it. It looks good in its place, but for most people it doesn't penetrate into real life. Mao almost never mentioned at party meetings. We heard more about Deng and so on. And when there was a bit of chit-chat, often it was about corruption. Most branch members no longer call each other Tong Zhi, the Chinese word for comrade, originally introduced by Sun Yat-sen and adopted by Mao as an equivalent of the Soviet Tovarich. In recent years, Tongzhi, which means the same will or same inclination, has been appropriated by China's gay and lesbian community. And this prompts sometimes ill-concealed mirth when it is still used by po-faced party cadres on formal occasions. Mei Ling's view of her membership now is chiefly pragmatic. I always thought I worked hard. I wasn't so stupid. I wouldn't just flatter the boss. It was simple. If they didn't like me, I would leave. There are other options in a big city like mine. You don't have to rely on the party, she said. But membership certainly helps, and she has not, in the end, left the party. In imperial days, the emperor was the father who incorporated China. But his capacity to control events faded as the layers of government got lower. The Communist Party's reach today is considerably greater. It insists on the capacity to approve or disapprove, to tolerate or silence every organisation, every appointment, every decision made, even every message posted on the internet in China today, whether it may choose to exercise that capacity or not. China does not even have a defence force of its own. The People's Liberation Army is the party's army. The name of the country, the People's Republic, is the party's name for it. The flag, the logo, the national anthem, March of the Volunteers, likewise. Last year, my old paper, The Fin Review, interviewed Chun Lifeng, the senior government relations executive at the ICT giant Huawei, which is based in Shenzhen, next to Hong Kong. And she said, the relationship between Huawei and the Chinese government is just the same as the relationship between any Western private company with their governments. Huawei is outside the system. As anyone who knows China would attest, this is not true. For an organization, as an opposed to an individual, to be outside the system means to be outside China. And sure enough, when I had visited the Huawei headquarters and asked questions about governance, corporate relations staff there eventually disclosed to me the role played by the party committee within the Huawei structure, whose role includes a capacity to vet candidates for key positions on the board and in other top jobs, and as one would expect. Ultimately, as Walter and Howie say in their excellent book, Red Capitalism, the party also believes it's best placed to price risk. What's happening today? Some people, including our own Liu Kuo-wan, also known as Kevin Rudd, who described Xi Jinping as the man for the times, have loaded expectations onto what they call the new leadership in China. In fact, they're not really anything of the sort. Xi and Li Keqiang, the number two, were already on the Politburo Standing Committee, the people who ruled China for 5 years before becoming the top and number two leaders at the Party Congress last November. They are ultimate insiders, perhaps with a slight twist. Yao Ji from University of New South Wales here has described them as essentially political leaders, while their predecessors over the 20 years or so before that were chiefly technocrats. They may be preparing for groundbreaking economic reforms needed for the long-postponed restructuring from a focus on manufactured exports and on state-owned enterprises towards domestic consumption, the services sector, and opening access for the private sector to get capital it needs. But there are no signs of interest in political reform. In fact, the opposite. We're seeing Xi's mystical key concept, the Chinese dream, being used as a counterpoint to the seven perils recently outlined in the party's document number 9. These are the seven perils. Universal values, the Western concept of press freedom, civil society, civic rights, crony networks, judicial independence, and nihilistic criticism of the historical mistakes of the party. She is also seeking to reintegrate the bifurcated history of the People's Republic, bringing the three Mao decades back into the fold. A major attack has been launched against constitutionalism, the idea that the Chinese constitution should have a status of its own that is not subjugated to party control and interpretation. People's Daily, the party paper, said constitutionalism belongs only to capitalism. Sometimes you hear people say that you have to give China more time. But it's over 100 years since the Qinghai Revolution that removed the last Manchu emperor, Puyi. China did evolve in the ensuing decades towards a form of democracy, a form of rule of law, only to see that thwarted by the Civil War and its outcome. Whereas Britain and the US developed, as they industrialized, institutions to inhibit the power, both of capital and of the modern state, in China it's the state and the capital it commands that drive development unchallenged. There are limits to the kind of institutional relationships that foreign organisations and states can enjoy with this unique polity. A Chinese commentator, Wei Gu, points out that for many in the middle class today, the squeezed middle class, as he calls it, they have no appetite for outright revolution, but they're weary of injustice and unfairness, and the oligarchy provides a vanishingly small outlet for them to seek redress on the issues they care about most. The availability of safe food, fair access to good education and healthcare, and more safe air. China is continuing to grow rapidly, but some are calling it toxic growth. A crackdown is underway in China's burgeoning social media world. Charles Chow, the chief executive of Sinocorp, which dominates the Weibo platform, China's version of Twitter, said a fortnight ago, the government is working to make the internet a more carefully managed space. Ever since my sainted employer, Rupert Murdoch, may he be blessed, expressed optimism that China would be utterly changed by homes gaining access to satellite TV. Instead, the party state has made good use of each technological advance to gain more knowledge about every individual and family in China and a greater capacity to control them. Every blogger has to register his or her true name and identity card number with the internet service provider first. A campaign has been launched against rumour online and arrests made of several of the so-called special Vs, bloggers with verified followings, often of several million. The party journal Seeking Truth recently complained of unhealthy sentiments being communicated in the social media. Arrests have been made around the country, including of a person described by the official media as a self-appointed whistleblower, as if there could be any other sort. Another has even been charged with defaming China's most famous model worker, Lei Feng, 50 years after he died, by claiming he wore a leather jacket and leather shoes when his image had been one of thrift. And that brings me to a few final words about the cover of the book. The designer Peter Long just saw an image he liked, and I too feel it fits the theme well. But he didn't realise that the central figure in the appropriated propaganda painting is that of model worker Lei Feng, who was orphaned early, joined the People's Liberation Army, and at just 20 died when a truck he was directing backed into a telegraph pole that fell and hit him. A new video game enables players to be Lei Feng online and fight spies and defeat the enemy, and ultimately, if you're victorious, to be ushered into the presence of the great helmsman himself, Mao Zedong, a religious goal to which we all may still aspire. Lei is on the cover here, holding a story called Red Crag, set in Chongqing during the Civil War, against the nationalists. On the table, treats in store for the children as they relish their party time with their age-defying model worker. Zhang Jiguang, about a volunteer in the Korean War, and the selected works of Chairman Mao. Sadly, films recently released to honour the 50th anniversary since Lei Feng's passing were often screened to completely empty cinemas. Times and heroes have changed. Modern celebrities, including people like the alluring TV host, dancer, singer, model and designer Namu, who described herself to me as half Mother Teresa, half Madonna. She's an example of the vivacity of the China beyond the party, which is the topic of my final chapter, which also features some wonderful philanthropists and founders of charities. They point to ways in which although the party has zealously wrapped itself around the identity of the whole Han Chinese world, it has not succeeded in displacing China itself. Most Chinese people are essentially highly individualistic and resilient. The culture of the party is something else, a given that for now appears irreplaceable. A Hong Kong friend of mine sent me a message a couple of days ago after reading a review of this book in the South China Morning Post, saying that I appeared to be one of the only Australians to have made money out of the Chinese Communist Party. I earnestly hope that he'll be proved right. When Palgrave Macmillan planned to publish the book internationally out of New York, they told me they had to change the title, Party Time, which is my title, because American readers don't get puns and will be confused, maybe expecting Party Time to comprise a celebration of fun with the Hiltons or Kardashians. So this is what they've come up with. The Party Forever. I'm not expecting the CCP, unlike the ALP, to lose office anytime soon. I'm looking forward to royalties forever. Thank you.
Many thanks, Rowan. And so we come to questions and discussion. Thanks also to Deborah Hazelton, who introduced our speaker. And the copies of Party Time, we've got the Australian edition. And Janet Grundy's got copies there, and I'm sure Rowan Kelly could be delighted to sign any. So we'll finish no later than 7. Many of you have been here before, but for those who haven't, that's what we do. So I'll start off, and I'm sure as I say, thank once again, thanks to Clayton Yates for the use of this fine facility. When I was a lad a long time ago at university, when the great helmsman was a bit of a hero to many of our academics and fellow students, there was a reference to the Great Leap Forward and the Great Cultural Revolution. The word great now seems to have disappeared, and we talk about the Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. And you referred to the Great Helmsman, but What is the legacy now of those terrible times of privation and murder, and from the antis campaigns into the leap forward into the Cultural Revolution? Is this topic discussed within or outside the party, and how would you assess Mao being regarded now within the party and outside the party?
So people talk about talk very little about the whole 30 years, actually. We're still finding out about what happened, the Great Leap Forward. We're discovering just how many people died and constantly being revised. The stories of cannibalism, horrific events. So now people are thinking most a recent book called Tombstone, research by Xinhua veteran at a party in government records, sort of estimate is pretty well firmed up as 30 million people died during this period. And the party itself doesn't like to go back to this period. In fact, when people in education in China, mostly history ends in 1949, with Mao talking, Mao in the Tiananmen Gate, standing where emperors once stood and saying to people in the square on October the 1st, 1949, China has stood up. Even that is not right. He didn't actually say this. He said it at a party meeting a couple of weeks earlier. But all Chinese school children know that he stood up on October the 1st and said this, which is a lie. But then history more or less stops. So people might have a bit of the post-1978 Deng Xiaoping reform period. And the verdict about Mao is 70% good, 30% not so good. This is Deng Xiaoping's verdict. And people like to leave it at that. Mao is still on the gate. Mao is still in the middle, disfiguring the feng shui people that tell me of Tiananmen Square. Very hard to remove. And when people in the party review the downfall of the Soviet Union, they've mostly point to the undermining of the reputation of Stalin as being a core feature of the destruction of the USSR. And blame Gorbachev. And so no one wants to be a Gorbachev and do that. They just don't want to open this door. And a professor of history said to me, when a academic article had been written about the Boxers, about the Boxer Revolution, and he said these people were cultists and anarchists. And he said, no, they're precursors to the Communist Revolution. And he said, we in the party have pools of clear water. We can see what history was like. And if you revisit them, it's like messing up the water. We can't see clearly anymore. And that's the situation. And while many people outside are talking about it, people who grow up inside China really don't know too much about what happened, except anecdotally through what their families told them.
Thank you.
Just stay there.
Yeah.
See.
Okay. So,
Zev. Well, not that long ago, Soviet Union was looking like forever as well, and it finished very fast. How stable is the Communist Party rule, especially when you look at some statistics that indicate that social unrest is growing in China and growing quite rapidly?
That there are many what they call mass incidents in China. Mm-hmm. And they ascribe this to growing wealth inequality. This is what they say, and perceptions of corruption as being major factors in this. And the party feels that it can keep control of this situation as long as people aren't allowed to join up the dots. So you can have local action, but what is really unacceptable is for people to start to compare notes around the country and join up. So Liu Xiaobo, a very interesting thinker and writer, who was one of the main drafters of Charter 08, which was sort of echo of the Czech charter, was jailed for 11 and a half years because he joined up the dots and he put out a and he connected critical thinkers from around the country. He's one of the people I think I might have been the last person to have interviewed him before he was arrested, actually. And so I think that they feel they can keep on top of things by dealing with the local situation one after another. They feel sympathetic towards those people, and they feel that for many people, it's still the case that people blame the local official and say, if only the people high up knew that particular offence against me or my family would be removed. Just as in the old days people used to say, if only the emperor knew. And China still has a petition process, a local one, and going up, and it's rather pathetic. You see people trying to put their petitions through this little hole in the wall in the Tiananmen area, south of Tiananmen Square. And people still believe that if only people high up knew. The Bo Xilai case is troublesome in that respect, because Bo is a very senior guy. His father was a famous Long Marcher and so on, as Xi Jinping's father. So when people of that seniority end up in court and in trouble, that starts to raise more questions. Will they be able to keep things under control? I think I wouldn't bet against them. I wouldn't like to bet against them.
So there's a lot of people here, so we've got to be quick. There's a question here, and then we'll go down the corner. Yeah?
Bo Xilai was a leftist, wasn't he? And his trial exposed quite some tension between the leftist and the rightist factions of the Communist Party. I was wondering how deep you think that rift goes, and who prevails now and who will prevail?
Mostly the people in the party have views that cross lines. So there's no... It's not like ALP, where you actually are a paid-up member of this faction or that faction. Cheng Li, a famous Brookings Institution analyst, makes these lists of people who are princelings or people who follow the Youth League and so on. But in fact, they cross boundaries all the time. And essentially, they have this thought that we will fall together. So I think it's fair to say that people, Xi Jinping has taken some of those popular ideas of Bo Xilai, like a little bit of return to the Mao era, the singing red songs and so on, they're not going to do. But some ideas they're going to resurrect. But essentially, he's not going to return to the days of state control for the entire economy and so on, centrally planning. And I think that the factions are bound to exist in such a big institution, because it's the only way it can be managed. But I wouldn't say they're hard and fast.
Right down the corner there, yeah.
Yes. Sure, this is a very naive question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I don't know the answer. Do Communist Party members vote in any sense of the word? Like, do your friend, do they turn up the branch meeting and vote for...
Yes. That's right. So they have... it's like a pyramid structure. So you vote people onto the party, the local party congress, and then in the city or the township or the province, and then they go up to the... they end up... up there. But mostly the name's already provided. So you don't go to the meeting. Like Mei Ling said, she didn't go to a meeting and say, I quite like my friend so-and-so. You choose from the people, and sometimes there's no alternative. You just vote for the people.
So it is like ALP.
I think I'll leave it here. There's a question here. Yeah.
It's Kerry Brown from the University of Sydney, and it's good to finally meet you. I have a question about the party is a source of profit, And it's been phenomenal, absolutely incredible, the amount that it has been able to monetize power. And the cases recently of British or Australian business people, like Peter Humphrey, for instance, or I think 25 Australians in prison at the moment in China. I mean, you covered this sector while you were there until you left recently. I mean, shouldn't we be more worried about that? Isn't that very disturbing, that people who are close to people in the party and are having access to this phenomenal profit-making that the party has been able to do, that seems to be the core thing that its function is now, that in fact they are really being hurt, and that Peter Humphrey, for instance, was on TV confessing recently. I mean, is this something we should sort of start being very, very concerned about?
Yes, I think so, yes. But we tend in Australia to feel helpless. Our officials tend to take a very low-key position. Our politicians haven't really pushed this, you know, as you know better than me. In the old days, there was a visit, and then before the visit or during the visit or after the visit, there was a sort of, it was like a hostage situation. Someone might be released but we don't even see, the Chinese have stopped playing that sort of a game, it seems to me. And I think this is, people are in jail for offences that are not offences that we would recognise and maybe are even only vaguely recognisable in Chinese law. Almost every country in the world now has China as its number one economic partner. This creates enormous power in those sorts of positions. I'm trying to think of, do you think that there's even America doesn't seem to have an impact on this, does it?
Well, got to be quick, yep.
No, but the thing that's odd about the Fukushima case is that it involved the death of a foreigner.
And yeah.
We were very, very relaxed about that. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, someone has been, of course, charged and convicted and sentenced to death suspended for that offence, so that it hasn't just been left.
Okay, so Tony.
Yeah, over the past 60 years or so, there are three major charismatic figures, Mao and Zhou Enlai and Deng Xiaoping. Apart from those people, the leadership has been rather dull. It's been said that Xi Jinping has aspirations to rise above that horizon and become a figure of personality. Do you agree with that, or perhaps you could comment on what you think?
He certainly looks.
Turn out to be.
Yeah, he looks different, doesn't he? I mean, he's got an open face. He talks in a more natural way. Certainly than Hu and Zhang, his two predecessors as General Secretary. And so I think that's possible. Is that a good thing or not? I'm not really sure. I myself am not a great fan of charismatic political leaders. You know, I tend to think it leads people and countries into strange places. And in a way, China being run by a committee is not such a terrible thing, because while it means that they may not plunge into great reforms that some people would like, it means they probably aren't going to go back to casual cruelties that we saw in the past to that extent. So, but he would quite like to be, I think he would quite like to be that figure. He's got 10 years ahead of him, and we'll see.
Question down here. Yeah.
Thank you, Ron. Ron, my name is Leonard Young. I have to ask the view that in the West, over the years, they have documents called the Magna Carta, which uphold individual rights and so forth. Could you please give us a view on why, after 5,000 years of civilization, the Chinese have not seen the need?
So just for the podcast, there's no Magna Carta in China.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think many people in China, if you ask them what change would they most like to see, it would be the introduction of a rule of law, you know, and a way that they could have their time in court. And This is a real issue that I think people feel quite strongly about, and as people become better educated, they feel more autonomous. I think this is the sort of thing that people... This is a question that Chinese people are quite understandably asking. The party tends to feel if you give an inch, then if you allow any institution to exist which is autonomous, which over which we don't even have the capacity to control, then I think this is a real... They perceive that as a real problem for them. But... and of course, Magna Carta was conceded when the barons rather than the common people got together. And maybe that's the only way that it's going to happen in China, when people already in power decide they want to concede that in order to hold on to the bigger picture. Maybe this would happen later on. Yeah.
Question here.
Yeah, I think... Most of what you say is absolutely irrefutable. The Chinese Communist Party is now the state. Talk about, it always has been, talk about the state as some different entity is completely wrong. And in terms of society itself, it's been extraordinarily successful in terms of motivating, stabilising in many respects, and rendering effective much of society. But I wonder if its Achilles heel isn't economic. It's a command economy at base. It has forced savings effectively because the population has few other places to save other than its state-owned banks. It allocates resources not by any price mechanism or genuine competition, but by fear. And I just wonder how long you can run an increasingly complex economy and therefore society on that basis.
Yeah. Okay.
Or whether eventually that will collapse.
I tend to agree with you. It's quite surprising that we haven't seen more fragmentation already from there. I myself, when I first started writing about China, saw this, that state-owned enterprises were particularly... you saw that they were hopeless in many ways. And then Zhurongji started to reform them. So there's a capacity within the system to do just enough to get on to the next stage and to keep the thing on the road. As I said before, I'm not going to bet that at any particular time the economy will start to crumble, but any one of those events could start to trigger it. When Deng Xiaoping, after Mao died, when Deng Xiaoping decided to, and the catastrophe of the Cultural Revolution, decided to re-establish a relationship between the party and the people, he agreed an unwritten contract with the Chinese people that we will keep living standards rising, you let us rule as we have ruled. And if that contract is not kept, if living standards flounder, then some of those questions may come into play.
Robert?
Rowan, I'm just wondering about the party time in Beijing, Shanghai and the other big cities. What about the country, the great bulk of Chinese who live in the countryside? How are they faring in all of this? Do the Chinese authorities still prohibit journalists and others to actually have access to what's this big story that's going on in the countryside?
Now, if you're accredited to Beijing, you can travel inside the country, except to some places like Tibet. And that's why I had to accept going there accompanied. There's no other way to go. So, now the population is getting to be 50-50 countryside and in the city. So many people have moved in to take advantage of opportunities in the cities. So it's been quite a rapid move of people, of urbanisation. And I'm not an expert at this, but some people say that there are good opportunities now, and that some of the people who might have gone to work in factories are finding economic opportunities in the countryside. And we in Australia, of course, are looking to food industry as being our new a new thing after mining. Mining's still carrying on, but it's a new growth thing. And in China, likewise, there's a capacity for greater efficiency in production of goods, and certainly a greater capacity and for people to spend more and on foodstuff. So I think there's opportunity there.
It's time for two last questions. So Chin Jin and then Anne. Okay. Yes, quick. Got to be quick, Chin. Yep.
Okay. You just visited Tibet, so I'm asking, do you see any sign or any atmosphere that the policy change that the Chinese government towards Tibet towards?
Question whether there's any policy change with relation to Tibet.
Well, I think that Beijing feels it's working what they're doing in Tibet, pouring loads of money and getting provinces, state-owned companies to put money in there, and building a better standard of living for Tibetan people, completely locking the Dalai Lama out. They're never going to speak to him again. They'll wait for him to die, and then the new Dalai Lama will be someone they will confirm, and therefore will be someone that Beijing will deal with and will live in Tibet again. I think when people have talked about the expansion of China and concern about whether China is going to move into the neighbourhood, I think in the minds of many Chinese people, the west of China is already an area we can move into. The Han Chinese are moving into what seems to be empty spaces, in a way, in Xinjiang and Tibet and so on, and Gansu. And I think it's an area of opportunity. But on the other hand, I think what came home to me was the unbelievably intense feeling of Tibetan people of religious affiliation, and this is a dominant thing in their life. It's not going to go away, and it's going to keep there. And of course, it's becoming big in Chinese people's lives. Lots and lots of tourists there, and many of them are devout Buddhists who see Tibetan Buddhism as a particularly high form of their faith. And so I think we haven't seen the last of Tibet as a complex challenge to China.
Final quick question. Yeah.
To what extent is the glue, the idea of Chineseness, and the party manipulates this to a great extent, where once it may have been isolated, conceit about their importance as an individual race, now it's a kind of competition with the world. They have this pride in themselves and their belief that they are superior, and that at all stages where they might fall into factions or whatever, they come together because of this oneness of China.
Yeah, I think that's an understandable thing, and particularly people have been educated into 150 years of being maltreated by the world, being bullied and so on by foreigners, and history lessons quickly run through the dynasties. But then 1840, we have the start of the Opium Wars, and this is very much on people's minds. So the idea that now there's vindication is quite understandable. People can feel there's a vindication. And the party has smartly, as I said, wrapped itself around this. I gave a talk at Queensland University a couple of years ago, and a woman around the seminar table said to me, first question was, why do you hate, after I'd spoken, why do you hate China? And I said, I don't hate China at all. I love China. You know, why do you think I'm here talking about it? I love Chinese people, everything. And she said, because you've criticised Hu Jintao. And I said, well, Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister. I said, we're in Brisbane. You're very welcome to criticise Kevin Rudd. I don't mind. Say whatever you like. I won't think you're anti-Australian for saying this. But this is quite a difficult sort of concept to move into for many people.
Rowan, many thanks. Look, we have a rule of finishing on time. I know there's some more questions here, but I think we should finish on time. And there are copies of Party Time, Who Runs China and How, which Janet Grundy has. This is the first occasion on which the Sydney Institute's done a function with the Asia Society. Thanks to the Asia Society, it's worked very well. Thanks for everyone for turning up. I'll be very brief. it's a stimulating discussion tonight on a very important topic which has wide interest to Australians. Many of us follow Rowan Kelleck's work in The Australian, as we did before that in the Financial Review, and he always has a lot to say of interest, and again tonight he's done that. I hope the book goes well, and no doubt, Rowan, you're a very prolific type, no doubt you'll be back again in the future, but for tonight, well done and thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.